This podcast was recorded Thursday, March 19th at 12:31. Things might have changed by the time you hear this.
Yeah, like things will stop changing.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Let's talk politics instead. Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those shrewd politicians of, or Snollygosters, as we like to call them. I'm Ann Fisher.
And I'm Mike Thompson, and of course, is sitting in for Steve Brown today. You know, when we came up with the name of this podcast, Snollygoster, our first name was Snollygosters in Mugwumps, but that led to all kinds of Harry Potter search engine results. So we just went with Snollygoster. But a Mugwump is the exact opposite of a Snollygoster. A Mugwump is hardly selfish and shrewd. A Mugwump is above party politics. In 1884, the Mugwumps fled the Republican Party to support Democrat Grover Cleveland for president. Why did they switch? They were fed up with the corruption of their candidate, James Blaine, and Cleveland won by a very narrow margin, thanks to the Mugwumps.
It is safe to say most of our political leaders are performing as mugwumps these days. Objectively, you can put Mike DeWine, our governor, in that category.
This is no ordinary time in Ohio. This is no ordinary time in the United States.
The governor has put politics aside and led the nation, really, in making moves to slow the spread of coronavirus. He shut down the Arnold. He closed the schools. He shut down bars and restaurants. He called off an election and may very well shut down all non-essential businesses in Ohio. He has drawn effusive praise from even the most partisan Democrats, those accusing them, and there are a few of them, but just a few. Those accusing him of overreacting tend to be conservatives.
It's so, kind of interesting where the criticism is coming from. You hear more compliments coming from people who say, I didn't vote for the guy.
David Pepper has been very glowing in his praise. David Pepper, the chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party, we'll hear from him in a moment. He has been just glowing in his praise of Governor DeWine and his leadership.
I think one of the things that Governor DeWine has done is put others in front of himself. He's brought out the director, you know, the health director,
Amy Acton,
who's kind of been, you know, as people are calling her, the rock star, and we'll talk about that later. But, you know, she's been put out front, and we know that we have the experts talking to us.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, he's making these, I mean, he's a Republican governor, and he's shutting down business, which is throwing thousands of people out of work. It's hurting the economy. We're not going to see this for months. But this is killing the state budget.
He looked pained when he made these decisions. This was painful to this Republican.
And that's where the conservatives are, you know, they're not really faulting him for taking action. They think he's taking action too soon.
Yeah.
But as he and Dr. Acton have said, we have to act sooner rather than later to what is it called?
Flatten the curve.
That's our new term.
Right. I mean, and who doesn't have that chart memorized?
That's right. Flatten the curve. PPEs and flatten the curve. Personal protective equipment for healthcare workers and flattening the curve are our two terms we've come up with so far for this coronavirus crisis. The unilateral decision to postpone Ohio's primary 15 and a half hours before polls opened was the most shocking decision by the governor and one that did prompt some political debate. DeWine says he did it to keep seniors and the health compromised from having to go out and vote.
It would have been wrong to compel people to make a decision today whether they were going to risk their health, people who have compromised health, risk their health, to exercise their constitutional right.
As it stands, we don't exactly know when or how voting will resume. Secretary of State Frank LaRose has scheduled the primary for June 2nd, but Democrats have gone to court saying, oh, wait a minute, the Democratic Party Chairman David Pepper says LaRose does not have the authority to set election dates.
So the lawsuit's about actually saving this primary. There is no authority right now in place for the proposal for a June 2nd primary or any extension of the primary. So we had to rush to court today to actually preserve people's ability to vote.
Democrats want to scrap in-person voting and just extend absentee balloting until April 28th.
All right. Joining us to explain just what the hell is going on is OSU election law professor Ned Foley. He is now a podcaster. He co-hosts a new election law podcast called Free and Fair with Franita and Foley. Ned Foley, welcome back to Snollygoster.
Good to be with you.
All right. If we can, because it's really ingrained in this decision, but if we can, just for a moment, put aside the reason why Governor DeWine and his health director did it. How extraordinary was it for a chief executive to postpone an election 15 and a half hours before polls opened?
Oh, it is extraordinary, no doubt about that. But this is extraordinary times with this virus. This is an acute emergency that we really haven't seen anything. I guess, you know, people talk about 9/11, the terrorist attack, and how that caused the delay of a primary election in New York for 2 weeks. So that would be comparable. I mean, the planes hit the Trade Center on the morning of the primary. The virus kind of hit an acute phase, as you say, 15 hours before polls open. So a little bit different, but somewhat comparable.
Let's talk about the tortured process it took to get there. You know, he announced it at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon that he was postponing it because he didn't have the authority. He had to find some citizens, some senior citizens, to file suit saying they felt unsafe. He went to court. The judge ruled against them. The county judge ruled against them. Then, after about 4 or 5 hours, confusion, he had the health director, I assume he, at his order, shut down the polling places as health hazards. Do you agree with the Franklin County Court's decision to reject the postponement, Judge Fry?
No, I don't. I actually think that decision did not help the process. I also think, again, hindsight is 20/20, and I really don't fault the governor at all. And I wish the term wasn't mugwump, but I think you're absolutely right that we're seeing the difference between politicians acting in the public interest, which is really great, an exercise of political virtue. This is not, at least in my judgment, nothing that Governor DeWine did or anybody else, even if it was messy, was done, you know, for partisan motives or incumbency protection motives or any of the reasons why you might worry about politicians acting precipitously. So there was an emergency, and I think the mistake, if it was, to go to court. I think the governor could have acted on his own initiative, or Dr. Acton could have issued her directive without going to court in the first place. I understand it was a laudable sentiment to want to go to court. It's a rule of law idea. It's saying, hey, we don't want to act like politicians. We want, you know, to cloak this in the law. But I think they had sufficient legal authority, as indeed they ultimately had to exercise it, because what the judge did was not reject the governor directly. As you say, the lawsuit was brought by these private citizens, and he denied their relief, and he did so on the basis that he didn't think, as one single judge in Franklin County, he could rule statewide. And so he said only statewide officials could make this kind of decision for a statewide election. And so he really kicked it back to the governor or the legislature, but the governor had to act given the time frame. And so it shouldn't have gone to court in the first place.
Yeah, and the state Supreme Court ultimately, very early election morning, did rule in the citizens' or the governor's favor. But by that time, Amy Acton had already pulled the trigger on shutting down the polling places. So folks didn't go to bed that night wondering whether or not they were going to vote.
And yet they did anyways. And people did show up at the polling places. And some people are really angered by it. I think I saw the same pain in the governor's face when he called off the voting as I did when he was shutting down the Arnold.
Yeah, and you the know, bars and restaurants.
Yeah, exactly.
It's been a gradual progression of things that are coming. We don't know what's next. Frank LaRose has set a June 2nd new election date. David Pepper does not think he has the power to do so. What is your legal opinion on that? Can the Secretary of State set the new election date?
Yeah, so the way in which I look at this in legal analysis is actually there were two different decisions. And so Dr. Acton and the governor had made a health judgment that people could not go to the polls, and it was to protect the poll workers and the voters, and as you also say, to flatten the curve. I mean, the judgment was if you had too much congregation on that Tuesday in public places, you know, that might 2 weeks later really affect hospital beds, IC units, and ventilators, and so forth. So that was the health decision. And what that did was it created an election consequence. Under the federal constitution, everybody has equal voting rights. That's Bush versus Gore, that's Reynolds versus Sims, that's the 14th Amendment. What happened as of Monday night was you had already had voters who had cast ballots. All these absentee ballots had already been cast. There had been days and days of in-person voting already. And so if there wasn't going to be voting on Tuesday in local precincts, those voters would have been denied federal equal protection. It was Secretary LaRose's obligation as the chief election officer of the state to figure out a remedy.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter that the statute, the General Assembly hadn't given him the statute to pick a new date. He had a constitutional obligation to come up with a remedy. Now, you might quibble about the remedy. You can make a reasonable argument that maybe there shouldn't be any more in-person voting, even though that's what obviously some voters wanted to, right? I mean, there were people who didn't vote absentee or didn't go to the county early voting center, but they wanted to vote in their neighborhood on a normal election day. Now, maybe the virus makes that impossible even in June, and that the only thing left to do is to vote by mail. But there had to be some additional remedy. And what Secretary LaRose did was he didn't just cancel the election and pick a new one for June 2nd. He said, instead, we've got to just extend the election, given the health order to close the polls on Tuesday. It's a little bit like what happens when I think the Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner did this in one context, you know, obviously not in a virus, but sometimes you have to extend voting hours. Polls are supposed to close at 7 p.m., let's say, but there's been a power outage or a flood, I think it was, that Secretary Bruner faced in one location.
There was a traffic jam in Cincinnati one time. They extended hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it is unusual to extend an election, you know, that was supposed to end on March 17th, extended all the way to June. But conceptually, that's what's happening here is an extension, not a change of date. So I don't think the analysis in the lawsuit filed by the Democrats is correct, and I don't think it gives adequate understanding of the position that the Secretary of State was put in order to protect constitutional rights.
So Democrats can switch to all absentee ballot voting, but can we change how we vote in the middle of voting? Is that fair for other people who are maybe in the process of moving to another state? They're not going to get their absentee ballot in time.
Yeah, so that's an important point. I mean, the issue is, what is the best remedy consistent with the principle of equal voting rights once the health judgment was made that you cannot let people go to the polls on Tuesday, November 17th. You know that, and again, people don't fault that decision as a health judgment. Some people wish it had come a few days earlier so as to not be so chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean, the stories that we're hearing today about hospitals in New York without masks, and they're being told to bring bandanas and handkerchiefs from home, right? I mean,
So legally we can switch from the in-person voting day to all mail-in, do you think?
It's the same question. It's like, I mean, so what are the, you know, once it happens that there isn't going to be voting on Tuesday, March 17th, what are the options? Option number one is to just say, okay, we're going to actually just count the votes already cast and say everybody else is out of luck. I think that would be the worst option, right? That would be the most acute denial of equal protection. Option number two would be to say, okay, well, let's void all the ballots already cast and let's actually do a whole new election. That would be closest to what happened in 9/11 because voting had actually started.
For about a couple hours, because they opened at 6, 7 o'clock and the planes hit around 9.
Exactly. So you could, that's maybe the Ohio Supreme Court will look at that and now say, all right, we just need a whole redo. And then you could ask the question whether the redo is going to be exclusively vote by mail or whether the redo is going to try to have an in-person option. And you'd basically say, maybe the General Assembly steps in and says, we've got a little bit of time here. Let's figure out the best redo for the state, all things considered, that would be an option.
How about in-person voting, Ned? I kept hearing the governor and Frank LaRose talking about we'll just continue with the mail-in, but that could leave out some folks who want to vote early in person. If they do continue mail-in absentee, do they have to reopen each county's voting center and allow people to cast an absentee ballot in person?
As an abstract matter, I don't think so. I mean, Oregon has moved to completely vote by mail. There is no in-person voting in Oregon, and that doesn't violate the federal constitution. My own policy preference is to try to have as much in-person voting as possible. I actually think elections are better if they're in person, including by early voting, rather than just vote by mail. So I'm not a big fan of the Oregon approach. But I do think we have to realize this year with this virus, you've got to have a vote by mail option that's available for everybody. And I think there's a legitimate question, even looking ahead to June, about, you know, what's going to be the health conditions in terms of going to the polls.
Right.
I mean, I sure hope that people will feel it's safe to go to the polls. But, how safe are people going to feel going to the grocery store in June? I mean, people are going to have to, but,
Ned, I wanted to move on, to the general. Senator Sherrod Brown has said that he worries this is setting a precedent that President Trump could use to delay November's elections. Is there a parallel here?
Well, no. I mean, I understand the concern, but I think the general election is different from the primary. That's an important point. I also think the authority to do what Governor DeWine did and Dr. Acton did does lie with state officials. I've been actually looking at this pretty closely the last, 24 hours and may write something more on it myself. But, the 10th Amendment is part of the Constitution, which guarantees state sovereignty. And the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted that in a series of important cases, including most recently involving sports gambling, if you can believe it, in New Jersey. And what those principles and cases say is that, the federal government can't so-called commandeer, that's the word the Supreme Court used, they can't commandeer state government, kind of take it over. That would be a 10th Amendment violation. And so if the federal government ordered the state of Ohio to close its polls, or any state in the country to close its polls, I think that would be a 10th Amendment violation. I think that's true whether that comes from President Trump or comes from CDC or the Secretary of HHS or Congress. In other words, no part of the federal government can control Ohio or any other state's public health decisions. And also, voting at the polls is a state operation.
So let me run this scenario by you, Ned. The virus comes back in October, and governors friendly to President Trump cancel their elections. Governors in Florida, Ohio, Texas, Georgia, Arizona cancel their elections. What happens then?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I think
closing far-fetched, the polls, perhaps, but could
yeah,
happen.
Yeah, no. People are talking about this. It's important to think about it. Closing the polls is not canceling the election. That's a really fundamental distinction, and that's why Secretary LaRose had to act as he did even after the polls were closed. So if you've got absentee voting going on in all these states that you mentioned, a governor comes in and says, well, I'm not going to let people vote on Tuesday, November 3rd, again, that doesn't cancel the election completely. You've got those absentee ballots already counted, and then you've got the remedial question of what do you do. So, focusing on whether the election exists or not, if somebody like a governor tries to completely stop a November election, they can't really do that. Congress gets to set dates for the November election, both for voting for Congress itself, senator and U.S. representative, and then for president. So, again, there can be an emergency circumstance, whether it's a 9/11 attack or a virus, that causes there to be a problem with an election. But a problem with an election is not the same thing as canceling an election. So I don't think anybody but Congress has authority to cancel an election completely, and I don't think Congress is going to do that.
So if say, the governor of Florida says that it's unsafe for Floridians to vote on November 2nd, they would have to postpone it. Congress would make them vote at some point.
Yeah, although I think there's a reason. Florida, like Ohio,
has
a lot
voting,
of
voting, yeah.
Right, and I think, I think one of the constitutional questions that people are going to have to seriously ask is that, does the Ohio example, as chaotic and difficult as it was, actually tell us something about how to think about equal protection in November. So to use your hypothetical, and also turnout was interesting. You know, Florida went ahead on Tuesday, March 17th, and it seems like most of the turnout was absentee and early, as mm-hmm. opposed to on Tuesday. And so, if we see in November that by late October, you know, most Floridians have actually already voted. It might be that a permissible remedy is to say, if the governor says you can't vote on November 3rd, that you just say, okay, we close the election that way. Again, I don't like that remedy, but you have to look at it in relation to the alternatives. And I think it is similar to, again, imagine a scenario in which there's a power outage at a polling place at 6 p.m.,
Which happens.
I think we're talking about that already, right?
And occasionally.
And you say, all right, well, it's too bad somebody wanted to vote between 6 and 7, but we're not going to redo the whole election just because the last hour didn't work out properly.
Yeah.
So, you know, if 90% of Floridians have voted before November 3rd and the polls are closed on November 3rd, you might say, well, it's not ideal, but the least bad option is to say we've actually conducted this election and the governor can't throw away all the votes that have already been cast.
All right. Well, maybe Mike DeWine has got us all talking about it so we can be prepared for the fall should it happen. Thanks to Ned Foley, OSU election law expert and co-host of the podcast Free and Fair with Franita and Foley. Thanks, Ned.
Thank you, Ned.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We'll be right back.
On All Sides with Ann Fisher, we cover the topics that affect life in Central Ohio, from immigration to the economy to the continuing opioid crisis.
But the reality is, if you don't save someone who's overdosed, they have no opportunity to recover.
Hear thoughtful, in-depth conversations about the issues that matter now. Subscribe to the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, usually at this time, we award our Snollygoster of the Week. You know, it's a slightly cynical award to the shrewdest political move of the week. Well, during this crisis, we hope snollygostering is on hold. So instead of picking on a snollygoster, we'll do the exact opposite. We'll name our Mugwump of the Week award, a person who is doing extraordinary work for the public good. And this week, it's a no-brainer.
This is certainly an unprecedented time. It is this 1 in 50 years pandemic that we've been planning for. You know, we are basically slowly shutting down most of our structures of society. We're asking people to stay at home in the hopes that they don't engage in this logarithmic spread of disease. It doubles every 6 days. And if you think about it, everyone who's not spreading it, me not spreading it to 2 to 3 other people, and those 2 to 3 other people going out, that is how we can slow this down.
You know that voice. It's Dr. Amy Acton, director of the Department of Public Health. She's the kind family doctor presenting truly scary information in a brilliantly compassionate and authentic manner that we can all understand. It warms the cockles of my heart, Mike Thompson.
You just don't want. I anchor the live coverage every day at 2 o'clock, and I don't want to turn her off.
I know it.
I mean, other folks are doing a great job. When she leaves the mic, I was like,
yeah.
I want to hear more. So it's just she came out of nowhere, and I mean, she's very well in public health circles. I'm sure she was very.
And
well-known.
She's very accessible, yeah. Dr. Amy Acton, our Mugwump of the Week award.
Yeah.
But she's very accessible. She was coming on on All Sides, very eagerly, wanting to get this. She doesn't have any. There's no pretense with her.
No, she's like your family doctor. Telling
right.
you the bad news.
She talks about her own kids. She forgot her kid's birthday the other day. She was kind of like, and the next day she remembered and said, I figured it out, you know.
Incredible story. She came from tough beginnings up in the Youngstown area. It's just a great story. And she's won many, 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 many fans here in Ohio.
Lucky to have her.
That'll do it for Snollygoster for this week. Thanks, Ann, for filling in for Steve Brown.
You're very welcome.
Don't spread coronavirus, but spread the word about us. Tell your friends. It's a great way to eat up some of your self-isolation time. And for our student, we have to give credit here, for our student producer, Jack Long, who's also doing yeoman's work, across campus here at Ohio State for the OSU student newspaper, The Lantern. Thanks to him, and also thanks to our audio engineer, Eric French, who is at a safe distance on the other side of the glass, so really safe distance. I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Ann Fisher.
For Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.